welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, or welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox if you're a new listener. I'm very excited that we have a new show this week, that I had a chance to record one. It's been very sketchy out on the Tour de Peace, riding my bike across the middle of nowhere to get internet service or phone service. So today I'm glad I had the opportunity to present a new show. And our guest today is Bobby Seale, a very, very special guest, very honored to have one of the co-founders and past chairpersons of the Black Panther Party on with us today. Bobby's trying to make a movie of his life. I think it's very important because his story either coincides or collides with American history, depending on one's viewpoint. And so right now I'm going to play an audio of a press conference that Bobby Seale spoke at in San Francisco back in 1967. And when that's over, we'll be right back with brother Bobby Seale. So stay tuned.
We went to the Capitol. We were there to deliver a message based upon our understanding of what racism is and how it's inflicted upon us in our communities here in America, and deliver this message to the world that we must arm ourselves, that we are in imminent danger, that the concentration camps in Tule Lake, in Arizona, and Oklahoma are now being rejuvenated, reset up for us, and we will defend ourselves. The Examiner made a report back here in the last Sunday's paper that we were anti-white, that we hold no bones, this is a quote, pick no bones about being anti-white. This is a bold-faced lie. We don't hate nobody because of their color. We hate oppression. We hate murder of black people in our communities. We hate the gross unemployment that exists in our communities. We hate black men being taken off into the military service to be fighting for our greatest decade in American prominence, us freedom. In the Civil War, 186,000 black men fought in the military service, and we were promised freedom, and we didn't get it. In World War II, 350,000 black men fought, and we were promised freedom, and we didn't get it. In World War II, 850,000 black men fought, and we were promised freedom, and we didn't get it. In the Korean conflict, a so-called police action, a war, we fought there, and we didn't get it. Now here we go with the damn Vietnam War, and we still ain't getting nothing but racist police brutality, etc.
Bobby Seale, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Hello, good morning. How you doing? It's morning I am. In California, it's 9 a.m.
Right. Today I happen to be in Asheville, North Carolina, and it's kind of chilly and overcast. But, you know, as being a lifelong activist yourself, we wake up in different situations almost every day.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Well, Bobby, I am so honored to have you on the show, and I'm just very grateful for your flexibility in doing this interview today.
Thank you. Sure. Good. Yeah, I'm happy to be here, too. You know, I've been doing quite a few shows since January, near, you know, 5th or 6th, but we've been doing these shows, and we're moving along pretty well, and the Indigo fundraising site, development funds fundraising site, is has caused a lot of other interests, you know, and hopefully we're going to get these basic funds.
Well, tell my listeners what you're trying to raise the money for. I think it's a very worthwhile project.
It's a major feature film. It's my life story. My life story is so profound. It's as people tell me, you know, it happened. It's a life story film. My civil rights status of the 1960s, 70s. My organization that I organized all across the country, United States of America, the Black Panther Party, with all its free breakfast for children programs, its free health clinics, free preventative medical health care clinics, sickle cell anemia testing programs. Those are the main three that initiated programs. We wound up with 23 different types of community organizing programs, real grassroots programs, not just talk programs.
Right.
When we said Free Breakfast for Children, we organized real Free Breakfast for Children programs a block or two from their little grammar schools and had Free Breakfast for Children in the poor and low-income communities, the working-class communities. So I'm just saying these programs really is what was the real, catalyst of thing that caused the power structure from the president down, President Nixon down, to move to attack us and try to wipe us out in the year of 1969.
Yes.
And the black, in doing this movie, doing this film, what we're documenting is all based on facts that come out of the Senate investigation hearing against the FBI for organizing attacks on all our Black Panther Party offices, which caused shootouts by them coming to our offices, raiding, et cetera, and in some cases, 5 a.m. in the morning, busting in the front and door, not even announcing anything, shooting and killing my party members, murdering my party members. Party members trying to shoot back, and police officers, some 12 police officers were killed in this period of the Black Panther Party members trying to defend themselves. And, of course, I still have 12 political prisoners in jail today, but more importantly, this was a part of American history. It's catalyzed out of the African-American community, and when that organization grew and expanded, it developed broad coalitions with all organizational groups. We crossed all racial lines and ethnic lines and religious lines and organizational lines. We had coalitions of more than 30-odd different organizational groups in the country across supporting us in the Black Panther Party. We really had evolved to a point where Richard M. Nixon being elected in November of 1968, we know by fact now he had a meeting immediately after the election, not after he was sworn in, before he was sworn in, with J. Edgar Hoover. In December, J. Edgar Hoover is on national television saying that the Black Panther Party, my organization, was a threat to the internal security of America. By the time Nixon is sworn in, John Mitchell, United States Attorney General under Nixon, is saying by the end of this year, we will be rid of the Black Panthers. This is national news clips one we're pulling in this film. But remember, this is a drama. It's not a documentary. This is a drama we get ready to do. This is going to be a high-style drama of that political era and what really happened. So there we go. The FBI, we can document and show with other FBI information and the information we have from the Senate investigation hearing against the FBI once they'd done all this stuff, that they killed and murdered Bunchy Carter and John Huggins at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, in Campbell Hall, right after a BSU meeting that had given the Black Panther Party member John Huggins some organizing status with that organization and they killed them both.
Wow.
And again, after that, a month after that, John Mitchell is back on television again talking about who will be rid of the party in the year. Now, we know that this was orchestrated. It was direct complicity in murder of our party members by using provocateur agents, people who are not FBI people but killers, to go in and do this stuff. And then try to blame it on the US organization. And then the US organization capitulates and puts up two people who were not the real killers. But we have the real names in the Inquisition of the people who did the killing of John Huggins and Bunchy Carter. which is different from the two names that the people that the US organization put up. You see what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of documented factual information we have. At the end of that year, 1969, when they murdered and killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, they attacked their apartment where they lived, not the Black Panther Party office, at 5 a.m. in the morning, and then they tried to, you know, they had some phony so-called arrest, but they went in shooting and killing. But I mean, we have the old film footage of after the shootout, all the bullets that went into Fred Hampton's bedroom at bed level on one wall and at the other wall running perpendicular to that. This is 15, 20 feet of bullets at bed level going into a wall, et cetera, and then the other wall. I mean, this, and it was just horrendous when we see what happened there. So we call it fascism. You know what I mean? Old Hitleristic or whoever type murderous fascism. I mean, we're an organization. We're the Black Panther Party. We believe in the right to self-defense. We have a 10-point platform and program. We call for full employment in one issue, decent housing another issue, decent education taught us about our true history another issue. Another issue, we're calling for free preventative medical health care. Another issue, calling for an end to the robbery and exploitation of our community, and we want to build some community business frameworks, cooperative business frameworks, you know, to uplift our community economically and so on. You know, and point number 7 in that program said we wanted an immediate end to police brutality and murder of Black people in our communities. And we have a right to defend ourselves, you know, especially against all racist attacks. You know what I mean? Any Ku Klux Klan or whoever comes in trying to shoot, kill, and murder us like they've been doing for a hundred years since the Civil War, we have a right to defend ourselves. We went on in that 10-point program that we created in October 1966. To talk about the right to fair trials, to talk about the penal legal system and fair treatment, and we summed the 10-point platform and program up. Really, we finalized it with a paraphrasing of the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence of these United States of America. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, "Why did you do that?" I said, "I'm an American. And I'm acting in the manner of a first-class citizen, whether the racist thing is like it or not." So, you know, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for anyone, people to dissolve the political bondage which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth to separate and equal stations, you know, a decent respect to the opinions of humankind dictate that they should declare the causes which impel them to dissolve that political bondage. In other words, that political bondage that we saw as oppressing us, the institutionalized racism, the discrimination, the lynchings and murders that white racists and other organizational groups got away with, this is all oppressive, terroristic stuff that we were, as a people and other people of color too, not just us, were subjected to. Even poor white folks, really, in several cases, who especially was trying to organize in unions and stuff, they were subjected to the same kind of thing, you know what I mean? Along with, I'm just saying, get rid of that political bondage in that context is where we were coming from. But it was about political organizing to do it in my book, in my philosophy, in my organizing methodology. In other words, we created this Black Panther Party October 1966. We went out and began to patrol and observe police occupying our community. And we had legal guns. Our legal method was very legal. We patrolled for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so legal that the California State Legislature made a law that said we could not carry loaded weapons inside city limits. We had no shootouts in this period. That whole first year of the Black Panther Party, there were no shootouts. A couple of standoffs you know. But by and large, it was none. I led an armed delegation 6.5 months later to the California State Legislature, May 2nd, 1967.
Well, that was actually, yesterday was the 46th anniversary of that.
Yes, the Mulford Act that was passed then, back in that day, but that's true. Yesterday was that anniversary. And I led that armed delegation particularly and specifically to read our organizational mandate, executive mandate number one, and we were denouncing the Mulford group who was trying to put a bill through at the time to stop us from carrying loaded weapons, because we would not go out there with unloaded weapons if we're going to observe the police.
Right.
But my point is, that's what they did. And with that, they arrested me and all the party members, but they only brought charges against six of us, and that's because five of them got in front of me in this horde of press. I mean, 50, 60 press people all around me. I'm trying to walk down the hall. I'm asking the press people, where is the spectator section for the state assembly here where we can watch the state assembly make law? Where is this? Where is it located? And the press led me the wrong way. And several of the party members got ahead of me, five of them at least, and the press led them into the chambers, not the spectator section. So they're walking down the aisle with these rifles resting on their shoulders, you know, resting in a casual way, not in a pointing way, resting on their shoulders. And when I walk in, I look around, I says, we're in the wrong place. Wait a minute. So I'm running down the aisle trying to get the guys. I say, hey, you guys, come on, let's get out of here. Come on, Mark, you guys, get out of here, man. They've led us the wrong way. Come out. But the press themselves came into the chambers. The cameras, the TV cameras, they, four or five of them busted in, and they came in from different doors. And, of course, the president pro temp of the assembly suddenly is banging the gavel. He doesn't even realize that there are five guys in the middle of the aisle with guns resting on their shoulders. The president pro tem says, the press is not allowed in the chambers while in session. This is a violation of the rules. We cannot have the press. He's banging the gavel about the press because he sees the cameras. He doesn't see the guns. Me, I'm trying to get him out of there. A couple of the assemblymen has ducked under their chairs and their seats because they see these black guys with these guns, blah, 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 blah. We're led in the wrong place. I finally get them out, and as I'm coming out, another assemblyman is under the chair. I say, hey, man, I'm sorry. Press led me the wrong way. Come on, you guys, let's go, let's go. I was saying that to the assembly. I'm sorry. So that event gave my 6-7-month-old organization international notoriety.
Yes, a huge boost.
It went around on the front pages on newspapers all around the world. It blew my mind when I found out about it. I said, dang, I didn't know this was going to happen. But I'm just saying, that's that part of that political history. And I had less than 50 members in my Black Panther Party at that time. Less than 50. And it would not be any more than 50 for the rest of the year. For the rest of the year, that's important to understand also. So I'm just saying there were no shootouts, no battles, etc. After they passed the Mulford Act in late May, we didn't patrol police anymore. I mean, because we're not going to go out there with unloaded weapons. We did get on television and we did say that we have a right to observe the police from our windows, in our homes, in our houses, in our apartments. If they're attacking, it's one thing to observe them and watch them carry out a proper arrest. It's another thing if they come in and, you know, start attacking people, which is a lot of what was going on in the 1960s. People think police brutality today that they hear about, well, it was 50 times worse in those days. I mean, it was vicious. And we're talking in those things, not only all across America, but we're talking Oakland, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley community, you know, that exists today. But I'm just saying that's how bad it was. Now, that was one issue, though. I mean, we went after all those issues in our 10-point platform and program as we began to organize. And it was really after Huey Newton got in a shootout situation where Officer Fry attempted to kill Huey. But Huey grabbed that gun when he pulled the gun. And when Huey grabbed the gun, called himself trying to push it away, Huey was shot in the side. And in shot in the side, he wrestled with the gun, and then one of the bullets that was fired from Officer Fry's gun in the wrestling hit Officer Haynes, the other officer.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you have to read the court records and all this kind of stuff to understand really what happened there. So, and anyway, that happened. But I'm in jail at that time. I'm in jail when that happens with Huey. And then the police thinks the second person with Huey was me, but I'm in jail.
Oh yes.
They were out. The word was out. I found out later from Officer Williams. Williams was a police officer who was a good friend of that I knew, and we knew. You know, I talk about him in my book, Seize the Time. But Police Officer Williams had let me know about that. These guys are out to kill you. And they mm-hmm. were going to shoot you on sight because they believed you were with Huey that night. When Officer Fry wound up getting killed and wrestling and tussling with his gun when he pulled it out on Huey. Then Huey got out of the car and says, okay, I'm taking the arrest. But anytime he says, you've directed me to move. And as Huey is walking, he was saying, any time a police officer removes a person from one spot to another, technically under arrest, therefore, as I said in the car, I demand to know what I'm being arrested for. And Huey stops in front of the patrol car and turns around, and Fry is pulled out his gun. Huey is shocked. He grabs at the gun to push it away from him, but Huey gets shot right in the side, right then and there. And then they're tussling with the gun and falling over, et cetera, blah, blah. And that Fry gets killed in this kind of situation. Because once Huey's trial came down, he was found not guilty of first-degree murder, not guilty of second-degree murder, and Huey was convicted only of a voluntary manslaughter. And that's the way that really went down, because ultimately Huey won that case. You know what I mean?
Right. May I ask you about the title of your movie? Because the subtitle is The Eighth Defendant. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Seize the Time is the title of my book, Seize the Time. That was a popular book in the 1960s. The Eighth Defendant, I'm the Eighth Defendant. And we're talking about me, the Eighth Defendant, in the Great Chicago 7 Conspiracy Trial. Now,
right.
That was one of the most popular historical 1960s protest movement trials in the history. It was more popular than even my friend Huey Newton's trial that preceded that in 1968. So in 1969, I'm in jail. I'm arrested. I'm arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit murder in New Haven, Connecticut. After I spoke at Yale University, I went in and spoke at Yale University and went back to Erica Huggins' house. Then caught a plane back to Oakland, California, boom, boom, boom. So some months later, they says, Bobby Seale, boom, some guy lied. The guy who lied on me was a provocateur agent for the police. His name was George Sams, who really did kill a young man named Alex Rackley. And then working for the FBI, and when he supposedly was caught in Canada. And supposedly, but in every sense of our documents and stuff, that was a rendezvous point for him with the FBI. And in effect, they got him, of course, had him say for the state that I gave an order to kill the man. I didn't kill the man.
Uh-huh.
That's Connecticut. But the Great Chicago 7 Conspiracy Trial with myself, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Lee Weiner, John Ferrones, you know, Tom Hayden, who's a state senator here in the state of California, and so on. that these us seven defendants, this was the trial. As Jerry Rubin put it when we were first arraigned together in the court, in federal court, in front of Judge Judith Holman, Judge, and the press asked Jerry Rubin, what do you think about this trial? And Jerry Rubin, he was always great with theatrical antics. This is the Academy Award of people's protests. To be charged and indicted in this case is an Academy Award of people's protest. That was Jerry Rubin. But that trial got kicked off in September, latter part of September sometime in there. And in effect, my lawyer, Charles R. Gary, was in the hospital in San Francisco in a gallbladder surgical operation when the trial got started so much. He wasn't there. And in effect, I put a motion in that Charles Gary had dictated to me from his hospital bed to defend myself. And the judge, Judge Jesus Hoffman, denied it. I said, wait a minute, you denied the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution? Well, this set off a thing in that courtroom for me, because I'm not a lawyer, but I know my Constitution, democratic, civil, human rights. I know them. I know what they are, how they go down, et cetera, you know, and so on. And I'm saying, you denied me my right. You sit down, Mr. C. I says, no, I'm not sitting down. I'm going to sit up here and say what I have to say for the court record. And I'm pointing to the court recorder, you know, because this is the kind of stuff you're going to appeal, you know, and I knew that. I had that sense of understanding that, you know. Now, remember, I'm in jail without bail for the Connecticut stuff because it hasn't happened yet. You see what I'm getting at? And the other seven defendants, of course, are not. They have bail, you know, et cetera. But it set off arguments. And so in the courtroom, I tell you, the next couple of days, the trial gets started after he denies me my motion, and he mentioned my name. So I jump up. I say, I object. You mentioned my name in this column. My lawyer is not here to defend me.
But you were actually charged with contempt, weren't you?
Well, more than that, this went on for 6 weeks. 6 weeks, and he chained, shackled, and gagged me.
Wow.
For three days. Everybody who tries to do a film about this, they misunderstand the whole chaining and gagging. They misunderstand the progressive levels of types of gags I had. There's a progressive level of gags and chain, being chained, shackled, and gagged and bound to chairs, and different chairs used and different methods each day of the gagging, which is very important because I lose blood circulation at one time because of this ACE bandage that they wrapped all over my head real tight, et cetera. It was a thing, you know. And the arguments get on, and other lawyers are saying you can't do this. Jury members who come in and saw me start crying and take the jury out and bring the jury back in. I mean, it was something, you know what I mean, to be chained, shackled, and gagged. And then finally, I was able to flip my arm over under the straps, because first it was handcuffs, then it was hospital straps, and to pull the gag off, and then these marshals drop the chair. I'm bound all to the chair, and it falls into the section where the artists, there's about 10-12 artists in there who can draw. They didn't allow cameras in, but they could draw these pictures of me. And this chair falls into two rows of metal chairs, and I'm in this chair, and it falls down. All these reporters are jumping, trying to get out of the way, and the chair is falling.
Very brutal.
Oh, I mean, see, and everybody who's tried to make a film, I mean, the best one so far was Jeremy Kagan's film, HBO, 25 years ago, but he still didn't capture it. He still did not capture it. And they can't capture it. And I have to write this film, this thing, because I know it, and I'm my witnesses to everything that was said and who said what, you know, and what went down in that courtroom with the chain shackling, gagging for 3 days, how they beat me up and slammed me to the floor at one other time, and how Goliath, one of the moonlighting so-called deputy marshals, hit me in the chest. And when he hit me in the chest, I hit that chair in that modern courtroom with those wheels on the chair and rolled all the way back, and the chair bumps into the people in the front pews. I mean, that was a real circus of a courtroom trial. And in effect, the judge had to sever me from the trial, and he charged me with 16 counts of contempt, sentencing me to 4 years in prison for contempt of court. But once I won the other case, I went and appealed all that stuff. I won all that stuff, you know. It was trumped up crap. Even all the charges and everything against the other seven defendants was thrown out of the higher courts, threw it out, because Judge Judas Hoffman was just totally wrong, you know what I mean, in terms of how he went about. But the dynamic of the 1960s protest movement, I mean, young folks have got to know that they don't ever want to see this kind of fascism evolve again. You know what I mean? This is American history. I consider it part of the democracy project. You know what I mean? The human involvement democracy project, trying to evolve, you know, a more perfect union in terms of greater legislation and policies that empower people, you know, not avaricious corporate money rich, but empower the people, whether it's their bargaining rights, whether it's their right to be able to buy a house without being tricked into multiple flexible mortgage rates that cause 10 million foreclosures and stuff. My 10-point platform and program, we say we want decent housing fit for shelter of human beings. We wrote that in 1966. Decent housing fit for shelter of human beings in the statement that is applied today. Everything we said politically in my 10-point platform and program that we wrote back then.
Yes, so and it does apply today, and I think your movie needs to get made to inspire to greater levels of activism and engagement in our communities. And Brother Bobby Seale, people, if they want to donate to your project, they can go to bobbyseale.com to do that?
Yes, go. Please go to my website, bobbyseale.com, bobbyseale.com, and you will see on the very first page what I'm doing, and at the bottom of that first 2-3 paragraphs, you will see the site, my Indigo campaign website. You can click that up, and once you click that up, you can contribute anywhere from $19 up to $10,000. $10,000. The perk for $10,000 is I will speak at any event of your choosing, plus I'll give you all these books and other materials and stuff. Now, if you just want to contribute $19, I will send you an autographed poster of Bobby Seale and little Bobby Hutton in the California State Legislature, May 2nd, 1967, when I led that armed delegation into the California State Legislature. And then the next one, you get a historical poster of me. I call it Seeds of Time poster. And then the next one, you get for $27 contribution, you get a copy of my book, Seeds of Time. This and all shipping and handling is included in the contribution. And if you do the $35 contribution, you get a copy of another larger book called The Black Panther Party Reconsidered. And for the $50 Basic Plus contribution, you get Seeds of Time and two historical posters. And then for $60, a brand new book that just come out, you can get that one copy of this book, Black Against Empire. It's a nice hardcover book. It's a very good book. It's about the political history of the Black Panther Party by Josh Bloom, a professor at UCLA. And they've researched for years to put this book out, and I'll autograph these books and posters for you. For $100, I retrieve, you get Black Against Empire and my book, Seize the Time, and you get my DVDs. You get Public Enemy documentary, a DVD that I put together, and you also receive the other DVD of my barbecue cooking show. I did a barbecue cooking show with PBS television in Philadelphia a few years ago, and it was a fundraiser. You know, And I do not separate my politics from my cooking. I mean,
okay.
I'm a cook. I'm a hunter. I'm a fisherman. I was raised a carpenter, a builder. I was a stand-up comedian. I did stage acting and plays in Black Arts West Theater in San Francisco before the party ever started, and so on. You know, I'm an engineer. I worked in the engineering department on the Gemini missile program at Kaiser Aerospace Electronics here in San Leandro, California, just before I got into civil rights. I'm a carpenter and a builder. My father's a master carpenter and builder. My grandpa built the town, the small town of Wheelgate, Texas, my God, in 1920s, you know. And all my uncles and all these guys were carpenters, so I was raised a carpenter too when my father moved to California, you know, at the tail end of World War II is where we were. I'm just saying that I was lucky to have a lot of skills, trades, and professions by the time I got into the 60s protest movement, you know. So I try to, I'm an organizer. I love programs. And I don't like, it's not just talk with me. It never was just talk with me. Anybody sitting around doing some armchair stuff and just talking. I said, wait a minute, we've already went through that. We got the plans. We got the idea. Let's implement it. And unify the people and register the people to vote, you know.
And that's so, why we need to watch your documentary to be inspired to action. So I'm afraid we're out of time, Bobby Cilio.
Okay.
Again, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and for your time and for your life work of struggle.
And thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. I hope you got an important insider's view on the civil rights struggle, the black liberation struggle, and all of the movements from the 60s, really. And I think the story is so important because we do need to raise a new consciousness of struggle in this country, and not polite struggle, but, you know, and I'm not calling for armed struggle either, but a more committed and more, you know, struggle that tells the ruling class that we're not their subjects or slaves anymore. And as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and my connection with Community Progressive Radio, my producer, Mikey, for setting up this interview, my very honored guest, Bobby Seal, and, of course, you all for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan from Asheville, North Carolina, today on break from Tour to Peace. I'll be back in a few days in Amarillo, Texas with a tour. I'm at a conference for the National War Tax Resisters Coordinating Committee today. And so, again, I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.